Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
And Amy, so Nikki Haley is off to a fast start. The 6 votes out of Dixville Notch, New Hampshire, apparently were cast for Nikki Haley. That's the reporting this morning.
Big win, big win.
Yeah, we'll see if that what that portends tonight, and talk about it tomorrow. We'll talk about it a little bit more later in the show. But first, this topic we have been dancing around the end of last week and yesterday a bit too. Let's address it straight on. Is BLM Brandon not long for the mayorship in Chicago? There's this more than rumors. I mean, there are pretty good sources that indicate that he suffers from panic attacks for which he has been hospitalized. Anita Padilla actually talked about that on John Cass's podcast, the Chicago Way podcast as well. So Anita Padilla over, well, used to be at Fox News on her way to Florida, like the rest of Chicago. But the panic attacks, they're so severe, that there is consideration as to whether or not he can continue in his job.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Because I remember my sources told me on a Sunday a few weeks ago, and I'm trying to find the text message when I texted you, but it definitely was a few weeks ago, and they said, Amy, he didn't go once. He went twice in one night on a Friday night to the hospital, to West Suburban. And I've been trying to reach out to them, but because of HIPAA laws, they will not tell us if he has or has not been there.
Well, so with respect to the panic attacks, I mean, let's just assume that he has this affliction for the sake of argument. I mean, the idea that they would rise to the level that he would willingly resign as mayor, I can't imagine that. So the rumors that are circulating are, you know, reaching fever pitch because, of course, the implication is, and I think this is a little bit of a game of telephone, too. The more people talk about it, the closer he gets to resignation, even though nothing underlying has really changed. There's just no way. I know the arguments that he's over his skis and he doesn't even want to do the job anymore. I doubt that. I think he likes the job. He certainly likes the title and all the trappings, as most of these politicians do. But the idea that he and those around him, after securing this spot and this power, would let him walk away, or would or he would even choose to walk away when he has all these people around him that can do whatever heavy lifting needs to be done for him, that we're going to see some sort of change. And then, so that's number one. And then number two, even if he were to be compelled to resign because of his health, well, then the city council appoints, just like they did when Harold Washington died, and they appointed Gene Sawyer. So who are they going to appoint? The city council is controlled by socialists.
Right, but who's the vice mayor right now? Is it still Brandon Riley?
Brandon Riley's not running again. Brandon Riley's gone. Do you know that?
No, I didn't.
Yeah,
know
well,
that.
I have it on pretty good authority. He's gone. He's going to go, you know, be a flunky at some PR, the Dem PR agency, and that'll still give him the time he needs at Boss Bar. So I mean, it's just it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who the vice mayor is. They still vote.
Okay. Well,
it's not a line of succession. So the city council votes. They're going to vote Brandon Riley? Hardly. Have you seen the city council lately?
No,
yes, you have.
I know. Yeah.
So,
Signo
I mean,
Lopez or Signo Lopez.
So, I mean, I you know, in the one hand, the mayor, like any public official, should be forthright about his health if it's negatively impacting his ability to serve, in quotation marks. But on the other hand, I find this a bit distracting, and it's to probably a lot of sound and fury within the bubble, signifying not very much.
Well, he has, I mean, he is diabetic. He has type 2 diabetes, and I don't know if he has hypertension along with that or high blood pressure. Normally they go hand in hand, but panic attacks
does now.
Are real. I mean, when you, I'm sure you've never had a panic attack.
No.
But anyone out there that's had one, you feel like you're having a heart attack. I mean, you've lost all control. You need help. You need oxygen. You need to see a doctor right away.
Okay.
I'm just saying because but it might be, I heard that because he's over his head about the immigration issue and there's no money there and yada, yada, yada. But
there's
of course
money
he's
there.
In over his head. He doesn't even pay his own bills, for God's sakes.
So again, this is all interesting. This is all interesting, but the question that's relevant with respect to the rumors that are circulating, mm-hmm. Do you honestly believe there's a scenario under which he resigns on his own volition that's not, you know, related to any like forthcoming criminal indictment or something,
no.
That he resigns for health reasons of his own volition? No. No? No. I don't see it. Peggy in Chicago. You're in Chicago's morning. That's all, Peggy.
Peggy.
Yeah, I just found out we're the bedbug capital of the world.
Number one with a bullet.
Yeah, well, you know, you invite all these people up, and you don't check them or anything. Guess what they're going to bring with them? So the next time, you know, you're at City Hall or, you know, those buildings downtown, and you bring something home, hey, we invited them in, you know?
Well, thanks for the call, Peg. I think we were topping the list of bed bugs prior to the migrant matter, you know, because we have a lot of slimy, scummy, fat, disgusting, distended, unclean politicians roaming around.
Whoa, wow, that was a mouthful. Okay.
Well, trying to explain the bed bug problem, so, you know, how we've been afflicted with this for a while, of our own choosing. Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Hey, good morning, you two. He won't resign. You're right, Dan. I mean, why would he resign? He's too egotistical to resign. Two panic attacks, probably not that big of a deal. You know, they put people go to the hospital quickly now, like if they're, you know, with all the COVID stuff, you know, if they're breathing heavy, they think they're dying, you know, stuff like that. So I don't believe he'll resign in a minute. He won't. And Tony Preckwinkle, if he were to leave, which, well, Tony Preckwinkle would be mayor, don't you think?
No.
I think.
No,
why not?
There's no way in the world.
She's too old, or what's wrong with her?
Well, she's not too old.
She's not an older person.
What's wrong with her?
Well, you don't have to be an older
I don't know the rules down there.
Yeah,
okay,
but she
was the one who groomed him and put him into the spot, correct?
Yeah.
Grooms everybody.
She's the one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. I don't know.
Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. I mean, I don't think Tony would be interested to make that move at this stage. But you don't have to be a city council member to be appointed, though.
But doesn't it work like the vice mayor takes over until there is a city council vote?
Well, yeah, but they'll move that quickly, just like they did with Sawyer when Washington died.
Oh, Eugene Sawyer, I'll never forget when he was in the Swedish Day Parade. Oh, if only I had a camera back then, or video camera.
Why?
Oh, because he was, you know, because you had the king and queen of Sweden walking down Clark Street, and very regal and stoic, and he was like, hey, and just enjoying his, I mean, he was great, but he was kind of, you know, it was clownish behavior. It wasn't, you know, but he was having fun. He knew it was just a short gig. I'm mayor. Here we go.
Yeah, and just on the bedbug thing, just to round that out, fourth year in a row, Chicago has earned the top spot in Orkin's top 50 bedbug cities in the United States.
Way to go.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have a rat hole here, too, now, so that's great, too, for tourism.
Yeah.
Did you see that thing? It's a squirrel, folks. Please, it's a squirrel.
Real attraction. And then I go again. If you haven't tried it yet, today's as good a day as any. The boat. On the Chicago River with the hot tub in it. Got that. And then you got the sea dog to look forward to in the spring.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, you know, things are coming up roses in Chicago. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. You had something you wanted to say about Tim Scott and his pending nuptials?
Yeah, the love story, okay. So he was interviewed by the Washington Post, and he said, well, as a guy who's mostly an introvert and on the quieter side, having to have a conversation about the engagement is a little, you know, uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But it's the most exciting thing I'll do with my life besides making Jesus my Lord. So that was nice. But then he also went on with Martha McCallum on Fox News. And, you know, she congratulated him. This is a good thing.
Posted a picture of you down on one knee. You know, tell us, you know, how you feel about getting married. And when are you going to get married?
Well, listen, 2 weeks before Christmas, I went to her parents and asked for their permission. Aww. And that started the process. I knew I wanted to do it in mid-January. I'm really excited. The date, we'll surprise you with the date. I'm sure that we'll get some coverage on that one. But I am so thankful to have found my Proverbs 18:22 and Proverbs 31 woman.
Well, congratulations, Senator. We wish you both all the happiness in the world, and we look forward.
This is my Proverbs woman with an arrow pointing. I can see the T-shirts now.
Well, they met in Bible study. They play pickleball together. She's a divorcee. She has three kids. We don't know. She's being very protective of their ages and names, which is fine. But I got a text message into the show. Dan and Amy, finally, it's about time. I'm so happy for him. I'm glad he finally brought her out into the open last year during the campaign. Not sure why he had her hidden away. I used to think he was gay or something, or just asexual, until she appeared. And even then, people were saying it was just for the campaign. I disagree. They look lovely together. This is exciting.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
all
great.
Right.
Yeah.
That's, well, great. We got another story in the romance department.
Oh.
It's not quite as uplifting, because we're going to talk about Fannie Willis down there in Fulton County, Georgia. But can I just say something about this horrific murder that occurred in Tinley Park?
We've had a lot of murders this past 2 days.
Well,
yes,
yeah.
The mom and the three daughters.
Right. So the father murders his wife and his three daughters. Does not kill the son. I understand that he made the 911 call, the father who allegedly committed these acts.
Yeah, he was sitting there when police arrived. Mm-hmm.
So, anybody hearing anything in Tinley Park about that? I know this is being characterized as, you know, domestic violence, which it obviously is. But there's something else, I think, that may be afoot here that people don't want to discuss because of the fact that this is a Muslim family. See where I'm going?
Mm-hmm. I understand. And the fact that he let his son live because men are treasured. Boys are treasured more than women in the Muslim communities.
Well, I mean, there in a certain disposition within among some Muslims. But, Yeah, I mean, there's just a lot of rumors circulating about that family, and I can't confirm them, but those circumstances raise questions, and police should be asked those questions. It is not proper to not disclose the details of what happened in a case like that if and when you reach the conclusion, law enforcement reaches the conclusion that reaches a conclusion as to what they know to be true about what happened. This sort of papering over something as horrific as that with domestic violence, that needs to be explored more deeply. And whatever is found needs to be disclosed to the public. And I'm certainly going to press Tinley Park to disclose. I mean, this is, you know, 24, 48 hours after this was discovered. So I'm not, you know, rushing to demand. But there are these rumors circulating about people among people in Tinley Park who know the family.
Yeah.
And the way that it is being characterized in the Chicago media, sanitized, I would say, in the Chicago media. Maybe it's fair to sanitize it at this point until there are certain things confirmed. But this isn't something where you should allow the initially sanitized version of the story to stand, ask no questions, and let it just dissipate into people's memory. There's a question that needs to be asked about what happened there and what the motive was. And police need to, at some point when the investigation is concluded or they believe they have what actually transpired and why it transpired, that needs to be disclosed. That's what I'm saying. And there's all sorts of reasons why it is right and proper for them to disclose the motive in a horrific crime like that.
They should. Police are saying they've never been called to the home before, that's all. And the mayor was crying. The mayor of Tinley Park was crying yesterday.
The dad, the alleged murderer, mm-hmm. made the 911 call.
We need the 911 call. What did he say during the 911
call? I'm sure he didn't say anything interesting. What's interesting is he made the call. That's what's interesting. And now we have a conversation about motive. And then we ultimately have a conversation, and this also, too, obviously, the Will County State's Attorney's Office is involved, the conversation about what he may or may not have disclosed in custody and under questioning by police and prosecutors. Well, that all that stuff needs to come out.
Right. And I understand, but Will County sheriffs are pretty busy. I mean, they had 8 people murdered yesterday by a guy who shouldn't have been out on the streets anyway. This guy killed somebody randomly, and then the next, that was Sunday night, then on Monday, he killed 5 people in one house, 2 people across the street in a different house, fled to Texas. He was out on bond on a gun charge. Never should have been on the streets anyway. Ended up in Texas, got in a confrontation with police where he shot himself, killed himself. But that monster, what are we doing here? My God, I mean, more than 10 people shot in Will County in a 48-hour period?
Well, these are different things.
I know, they're different cases. I get that. And there's different situations, but it involves dead people.
All right, when we come back, I want to get over to Fawnie Willis, and let's talk about the latest and greatest with that prosecutor and, by extension, that Trump prosecution down in Fulton County, Georgia. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
Dan and Amy, so yesterday, a judge in Georgia ordered the court records in the divorce proceeding between the special prosecutor slash boy slash Fannie Willis' boyfriend, Nathan Wade, and his estranged wife to be made public. So that divorce file is coming out. This was brought by a defense attorney for one of the Trump 19 in Fulton County. Michael Roman is the defendant's name, who alleged that Willis and Wade had an inappropriate relationship. And then, of course, as everybody should know by now, there's a lot of records that demonstrate that they were traveling the world together, and she hires him as a special prosecutor. He's got very little background as a prosecutor, and she's the one who signs off on the payment of his bills.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's a Capital One. It was released. He bought her flights. He actually purchased her flight. He purchased a cruise for them, and he purchased flights and hotel room for Napa Valley.
And Fannie Willis, by the way, she was supposed to be deposed today. That got pushed off. Fannie Willis is accusing Nathan Wade, her alleged boyfriend, of his estranged wife, of interfering in her prosecution of President Trump and conspiring with Michael Roman, whose attorney made this filing in court, making the allegation. She literally, the words that are used, interfering, quote unquote, in her prosecution, conspiring with Michael Roman. It's interesting. Because, oh, by the way, there's one other thing that's circulating about Fannie Willis. One of the other defendants, Harrison Floyd, was friends with Nathan Wade, the special prosecutor, until he allegedly started making time with Nathan Wade's estranged wife.
Oh, Jocelyn Wade?
So, if that's true, and if there's any documentation, say, in the divorce file that's made public, in addition to the conflict between Fannie Willis, well, the conflict of interest she has with the retention of Nathan Wade as the special prosecutor, now her special prosecutor has a conflict of interest with one of the defendants. I mean, unless you don't think that a jilted husband prosecuting the guy who was messing around with his estranged wife as a conflict of interest.
This is like a soap opera, Dan.
It's getting very Springerish.
You know,
yeah.
But
what
was
like
cool
it.
Yesterday, Jocelyn Wade's attorney spoke outside the courtroom because they subpoenaed Fannie and she's not showing up.
It wouldn't matter who she is and what position she holds. If she's having an affair with my client's husband and he's spending my client's money on that relationship, I'm going to find out about it.
She's not showing up for subpoena. I just said that it was the judge pushed it off. Yes. So that's a judicial decision. Fannie Willis in 2020 had some comments about dating one subordinates, because apparently the previous Fulton County district attorney got in some trouble, accused of sexual harassment. Something like this. So she was making a clean break from the bad old days before she got there in Fulton County. This is what she said.
I certainly will not be choosing people to date that work under me. Mm-hmm. Let me just say that. You know, we are at a place in society where things happen in people's relationships, husband and wife. Sometimes there are outside relationships. I don't think that that's what the community is concerned about, although there, you know, there might be a moral breaking in that. I think that what citizens are really, really concerned about is if you chose to have inappropriate contact with employees. I mean, there's nothing that I can say on it other than it is distracting. It is certainly inappropriate for the number one law enforcement officer in this state. And it just, it really, really saddens me. And it will be very unfortunate if the taxpayers of this community have to pay for any of those lawsuits.
Huh. Be really unfortunate for the taxpayers of Fulton County if they have to pay for any of the litigation surrounding Fonnie Willis, her boyfriend, his wife's possible, his estranged, her boyfriend's estranged wife's possible boyfriend, and this whole imbroglio that Fonnie Willis created when she decided that she wanted to make her name by taking down President Trump and his alleged co-conspirators in Fulton County. You know what I mean?
What you talking about,
Willis? I'll tell you what she's talking about. She's talking about being a little bit of a hot water down there. Boy, it would be be really something. I mean, she is an example. It's just remarkable. Over the last, 8 years now.
Yeah.
It is almost like Trump selects his enemies, like they're cast to play his enemies for his benefit. Fonnie Willis is a good example of that.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So yesterday, the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision vacated a lower court injunction that prevented Customs and Border Patrol from taking down the razor wire and other barriers erected by the Texas authorities at the direction of Governor Abbott. 5-4 decision that included Judge Chief Justice Roberts as well as Amy Coney Barrett, and this drew the expected howl of criticism, particularly of Barrett, since she was the effectively deciding vote, and the belief that she had betrayed conservatives here. What's your view? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
I mean, what good is our federal government if you can't defend our border? Like, I don't understand how states are supposed to defend themselves if the federal government won't do it. And then you have her making that decision and letting God know who come into our country. I mean, did you see this? This is a Middle Eastern man who crossed over on Sunday who was a little lippy. No, a little lippy. I don't like the attitude.
If you are smart enough, you would know who I am. But you are really not smart enough to know who I am. But soon you're going to know who I am.
Wow, very easy. The entitlement.
No, believe me, I'm much better than that.
The entitlement, guys. Wow.
Because it's common for reporters to say, you know, donde eres, where are you from? And the reporter asked him that, and that's what he said. You're going to know who I am? That's the reason why you have the razor wire up right there. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36, type in DA, then a quick comment.
In New Hampshire over the weekend, Trump had a comment on judicial nominees, judges nominated and installed by the Senate, federal judges that are nominated by Republicans versus those nominated by Democrats.
The immunity situation is so important, and one thing I've noticed, and I've noticed it very strongly, if Biden or Obama, Democrat, appoint a judge, they go out of their way to hurt you. If a Republican appoints a judge like me, I appoint a judge, they go out of their way to show they're not biased. and that they can't be bought, they can't be this, they can't be. You appoint somebody, and they go out of their way to rule against you because they want to show that they are not in any way influenced by the fact that you appointed them. And you really do have two standards. It's an incredible difference. And hopefully the Republican justices that we have and judges that we have will make correct decisions. And what I want is just fair and correct decisions. And the president has
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Interestingly, you know, because this has sort of been presented as, you know, Customs and Border Patrol versus the Texas National Guard and and Texas law enforcement. The statement from the Border Patrol Union: the Supreme Court's decision is going to undoubtedly encourage more illegal immigration.
Wow.
Unfortunately, this means Border Patrol agents are going to be tied up dealing with give-ups rather than going after the criminal elements that constantly cross our borders illegally. The administration no doubt will say this is a win for border security, but if they sought rank-and-file input, they would be told this will do the exact opposite. Agents support what Texas was trying to accomplish in the absence of true border security policies from this administration. So the rank and file at the border, there's no conflict between Texas rank and file law enforcement and Customs and Border Patrol federal rank and file law enforcement. There's no conflict there. They both see the same problem. They're both desire to do the same thing. Abbott is unleashing his personnel to do that. And, of course, Biden is restraining federal personnel from doing that. So don't think that this is any conflict at the law enforcement level. It's strictly a conflict at the political level, conflict of visions, the open borders vision versus the border security vision. But in terms of the case itself, I understand the exasperation and the feeling like Amy Coney Barrett didn't fall on the side she should have fallen on. And I think there are arguments to be made in this case that are persuasive. And, you know, again, there's no details in terms of the basis of the decision of the respective justices, just the net decision to lift the injunction. But, you know, I can surmise maybe what Gorsuch and Thomas and Alito and Kavanaugh were thinking when they when they essentially voted to maintain the injunction. Mm-hmm. But just recall here that the federal government has, I mean, this is longstanding Supreme Court precedent, has plenary power over the border, meaning virtually absolute power, because of the power conferred to the federal government to control who comes into this country and who doesn't. Immigration isn't explicitly mentioned in the Constitution, but it is by inference with the process of citizenship and naturalization and so forth. So this case was about not about the what, but it was about the who. Who gets to decide? So it wasn't Amy Coney Barrett necessarily striking a vote for open borders or saying that she opposes what Governor Abbott has directed Texas state personnel to do. But it's that ultimately it's the federal government's prerogative, I think, when it comes to border security. And if you have a prerogative, then you can choose to exercise the sort of security to enact the sort of measures that provide security, or you can choose not to.
But it was working.
The razor wire up in
Eagle Pass was working. A reporter from Houston, Channel 11, was following these two guys, and they were just kept walking. And he goes, "Where are you going?" And we were trying to find Border Patrol agents to turn ourselves in, and we need to get on the other side. We need this down, the razor wire. But I know that's not what they were looking at. It's a bigger picture, and you're more intellectually minded than me. But
well,
I mean, like, my knee-jerk reaction, I'm pissed.
Well,
this was a working system where people were stopped. They knew, hey, don't come to Eagle Pass. You're not going to get through. Don't come to this country.
Well, I mean, very limited, but these are workarounds. I mean, the part of the whole point here is that, you know, putting razor wires and buoys in certain portions along the southern border in Texas, it doesn't address the problem. It just addresses the problem for that community mm-hmm. adjacent. But
it sends a message like, hey, they're doing something.
I get what it does. But again, working is not the question before the court. And remember, and this goes both directions, the people that are hailing this decision by the Supreme Court are the same people who decried the Supreme Court's decision upholding Trump's quote-unquote Muslim travel ban. Remember that was an immigration case, too.
Oh, yeah.
And it was 5-4 in favor of Trump. And it was largely based on the same argument about the plenary power that the federal government has when it comes to immigration. So, but again, that goes both ways. If the federal government does have this plenary power, then they can choose not to exercise it. I have power. I don't have to exercise it. I can choose not to. That's the definition of having the power. So cheering, the left is cheering this, the open borders crowd is cheering this while they were weeping and apoplectic about the decision on the Trump temporary travel ban from certain Muslim-majority countries. And now the right is sort of, some on the right are doing sort of the same thing. So this is where, like, we have to be a little bit level-headed about this. Let's focus on the responsible parties, and let's understand perhaps there are, this is just sort of, you know, at the beginning of this process. I mean, this was an injunction. So this was going to be litigated beyond this. And there are new cases that can be filed. And one of the cases that should be filed, if you want to talk about a stronger argument, I think, to make, is under Article 4, Section 4 of the United States Constitution. The United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a Republican form of government, shall protect each of them against invasion. Protect each of them against invasion. Now you have shall protect each of them against invasion.
Okay.
That is enshrined in the Constitution as a mandate on the federal government. The United States shall guarantee to every state and shall protect each of them against invasion. I think there's your argument to make before the high court that says if the government is not fulfilling its obligation, shall protect obligation, then we have to step in because it's a failure of government to exercise power it's required to exercise in this instance. And this is why, and we talked about this during the campaign, why people, when they were running for office, like Carrie Lake in Arizona, were saying, I'm going to declare an invasion once I'm elected governor. I'm going to declare an invasion. Why was she saying that? Because I'm saying that the government, the federal government, is in violation of their Article 4, Section 4 responsibilities. So this is not over yet. There's a way to do this. I haven't seen, I haven't read the particulars of the court filings in this case by Texas and the federal government. I've just seen summaries of them. But I'm not sure that this Article 4, in fact, I don't think this Article 4, Section 4 argument was made by the state of Texas. But there's still plenty of opportunity to do so. Tony on the South Side.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy Lamb. So, Dan, I have a question for you. We got to get in touch with the people who do the national political ads. So when Trump is running against Biden, we take the clip of that Middle Eastern gentleman that is saying, you don't know who I am, but you will know soon, and plaster that all over the country. If that doesn't wake up these people in America, I don't know what will. Just a thought, my friend. Talk to you guys later.
Thanks for the call, Tony. Yeah. It does sound threatening, doesn't it? Joe Naperville.
Yeah, I think Abbott messed up. He should have just said that the razor wire and the buoys was artwork and then had a First Amendment argument. And
yeah.
Also, don't
yeah.
You know, maybe put a crucifix in a jar of urine, and then the left would have supported them.
Yeah, and also subsidized it. Yeah,
yeah. And doesn't Texas have like their own state land that they could have just put this on and say, you know, "F you, federal government. This is state land."
No. I mean, I know Texas, you know, the Republic of Texas and all that, but not under the United States Constitution. They don't. Jordan in Antioch.
Good morning. Prior to the McGlynn decision here in Illinois, I would have been upset with Barrett, but I think what these conservative justices and these conservative judges are doing is saying, quit with the kicking the can down the road. This injunctive relief is just a Band-Aid, and I didn't realize that until we had to deal with it here with the PICA Act and all that, was they're saying, get to the merits of the case, bring an actual case, quit filing injunctions, because that does nothing. That's just a Band-Aid. That's something that we waste time litigating, we waste money litigating, and we never get to the meat and potatoes of the actual problem. And mm-hmm. I don't know what she... maybe she wrote the dissent. I don't know, but
that's the whole point. There's okay. No argument laid out by either side. It's just the decision in a situation this. Yeah.
I would be willing to bet that was probably the thought process going through her head was, let's get to the meat and potatoes and actually fix this rather than wasting our time with injunctive relief that does actually, it just prolongs the decision, right? So I would have been upset until I took a 30,000-foot view at this and realized that McGlynn and John Block explained it really well as to why he did what he did. And I think people need to understand that they're not turning against or being traitors to the conservative movement or their beliefs. What they're actually doing is trying to help you realize that quit trying to kick a can down the road. That does nothing. Bring an actual case and let's put an end to it.
Thanks for the call, Jordan. You know, it's in terms of not kicking the can down the road, something else, too. I mean, in this context where now, according to some recent polling, immigration is the number one concern of likely voters.
Right.
Ahead of even inflation. The political solution, too. I mean, this shouldn't just this. Yes, the courts are relevant here, but so is the Congress. And I thought Marco Rubio and Mike Lee had an interesting exchange on Twitter. Marco Rubio sort of rhetorically asking, how can there be a border security deal with a Biden administration that just went all the way to the Supreme Court to stop border security?
Oh, that's awesome.
It's a great question.
Yeah, it is a good question.
So what are we wasting our time with? Why is Mike Johnson especially? I mean, I know why McConnell goes to the White House and they have these confabs and they sit around and stroke each other. But what's even the point? Talk about wasting time and just getting to it already, as Jordan was saying. Let's just get to it already. And that means Speaker Johnson and the House Republican caucus, because Speaker Johnson can't do it alone, should understand this moment a little bit better than some of them seem to understand it and say everything stops. Just to reiterate what we've talked about intermittently over the last several weeks into months now, everything stops until and unless. At least remain in Mexico. If we don't have remain in Mexico right now as a good faith policy change, then we have nothing to talk about and we have no money to spend. And by the way, in response to Marco Rubio, Senator Mike Lee from Utah, amen. I struggle with the assumption that the Biden administration can be trusted to negotiate in good faith on any border security deal, given that the administration is fighting tooth and nail to prevent Texas from restoring order along its portion of the border. Precisely. So if you can't trust your negotiating partner, then that doesn't make for much of a negotiation, does it? That's why I say there is no deal to be cut. There is you provide this specific performance. You make this policy change, remain in Mexico, or we don't talk. There, nothing happens. We will do nothing. We will sit here until the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November and do nothing until remain in Mexico is done. And that provides a good faith showing for a deeper negotiation.
Yeah. And in the meantime, Americans are being abused. I don't know if you heard about this illegal Honduran who sexually abused a girl in Alexandria, Virginia, videotaped it too. They let him out. ICE finally caught up with him, and he punched an ICE agent in the face during the arrest process. And KJP is blaming Republicans for this one. Thank God for Ducey.
They released an illegal immigrant from Honduras who's charged with sexually assaulting a Virginia minor. Doesn't that go to show that as record numbers of people appear at the border, you guys have no idea what kind of people are coming into this country?
We need more resources. We need more funding, which is why we're having these negotiations on the Hill. But Republicans in the Senate is working with us. Republicans in the House are trying to get in the way.
Meanwhile, that American victim, she'll never be the same.
Well, and this is where House Republicans, starting with Speaker Johnson, hey, whatever Mitch McConnell and some of these quislings in the Senate Republican caucus want to do, they want to do. We'll have Mark Lee and Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley and others come over, and they'll stand with us. So this is your choice, America. It is the open borders crowd and these corporate panty waists who masquerade as Republicans in the Senate, versus conservative reformers who are serious about border security, so serious that we're not moving until we get the policy changes that everyone knows need to be made in order to have anything resembling border security in this country. And that's just it. It's very simple. They are completely upside down. I'm talking about those Senate Republicans and the Biden administration and, of course, all the open borders crowds and the Democrat Socialist Party. They're completely upside down on this. Even in deep blue states and communist red major cities, completely upside down. If that's not enough of, if there's not enough sort of moral incentive, there's just the expedient political incentive to do exactly what Tom Homan and others have said and what I do is just describing. Mark in the Western Burbs.
Yeah, hi. I've not heard this argument made, but, I feel for Texas and for Arizona and the border states, and I understand their need to ship these illegal immigrants out. And what I'm thinking, though, is are they playing, if this is an invasion, could they be playing into the left's hand by shipping all these invaders into the various blue states, and just the fact that these states have declared themselves sanctuaries, could that be an enemy's longer-term plan to have described themselves as sanctuary states, years before that led up to this? I know it's a bit of a stretch, but it seems like it's an argument that should be pursued.
Thanks for the call, Mark. Well, I mean, in terms of, are they playing into the enemy's hands by shipping migrants around? You can make that argument, but I don't think that absolves the federal government of its Article 4, Section 4 responsibilities. And just the basic point being, I'm shipping invaders to other places because I don't want them in my state, but they're still invaders. They still invaded. The federal government is still sanctioning this invasion, whether they wind up on Texas soil or Illinois soil or New York soil. It doesn't really matter, does it? They're still at a place that they have no legal right to be. So, I mean, the federal government could make that argument in the face of an Article 4, Section 4 challenge, but I don't think the high court would find that persuasive, including Amy Coney Barrett. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Trump in New Hampshire on the stump. I gave a shout out to our friend Brian Birch's group's Catholic Vote. I don't know if people caught that. Good. But use that as the opportunity to take a shot across the bow of the FBI.
Today, we're also very grateful to be endorsed by one of the nation's largest Catholic advocacy groups, Catholic Vote. It's called Catholic Vote. And I just want to thank them. They are incredible. Now, I don't know what it is with Catholics, but the FBI is going after Catholics. What is going on? Why would any Catholic vote for a Democrat? You two. Anybody, any Catholic being harassed? Now, why would a Catholic, think of it, what they're doing. I hear stories that are just horrible. Why would a Catholic be voting for Biden or a Democrat? Doesn't make sense. It's horrible. What they're doing is horrible.
I don't know. I guess we should ask Cardinal Supich that. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Somebody wants to take up President Trump's question. In the interim, another story about the FBI, which is really the segue here. Another story about the FBI's record. Maybe this will be a little bit more interesting to those on the left who have newfound admiration for the FBI when they're monitoring Catholics attending a Latin mass or signing on to letters to call into question the authenticity of Hunter Biden's laptop, or you know, other or running interference for Biden Incorporated altogether, spiking investigations, or not being forthcoming about what, if any, involvement they had in January 6th in terms of FBI personnel and assets on the ground in the Capitol, and what were they doing if they were there, Christopher Wray. And on and on and on about the FBI, the participation in the Russian collusion hoax. Oh, yeah. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Steve Garvey does. You know, in
this
California, with they have the top two vote getters. So all the Republicans and Democrats for an office like U.S. Senator are thrown together. The top two finishers go on to the general election. So this debate that featured Adam Schiff. This is, again, to replace DiFi. And the Republican is Steve Garvey. Hall of Famer Steve Garvey. He's a Hall of Famer, isn't he? Yeah. I think so. Anyway, Steve Garvey's 75 years old, but he looks good.
Yeah, he does look good.
And he was getting right after Schiff, and, you know, Schiff, morally indignant. How dare you question Adam Schiff's integrity? If there's one thing Adam Schiff is known for, it is his integrity.
Sure.
This is a man of candor and character. So that's how this exchange, or this is how that exchange went.
Alex, I'm going to insist on answering.
All right.
Just called a liar by Mr. Garvey.
Okay, 30
Mr.
seconds.
Mr. Garvey, I was censured for standing up to a corrupt president. And you know something? I would do it all over again. Because that corrupt president, that president who's been indicted with 91 felony counts, that president that you won't refuse to support, yeah, he's a danger. And I will stand up to him and Kevin McCarthy and Jim Jordan and any of those MAGA enablers of his in the Congress. The reason why our democracy is in trouble is because folks don't have the courage to stand up when they need to.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sir?
We're going to keep moving.
Let me just heap that. Vote my name.
All right. Real quick.
Sir, you lied to 300 million people. You can't take that back.
Wow. Touch them all. Yeah, real simple. You're a liar. You lie to 300 million people. That's what you do. Your human excrement, which I would have added. But, you know, Steve Garvey's classier. So here we go. Back to the FBI. You know, the Russian collusion hoax, it's still very present because you have Adam Schiff, the leading contender to replace DiFi. Man convicted in a post-9/11 terrorism sting, ordered freed from prison by a judge who criticized the FBI for relying on unsavory confidential informant for an agency-invented conspiracy to blow up New York synagogues and shoot down National Guard planes. This happened Friday, but it dates back 15 years. U.S. District Judge Colleen McMahon granted James Cromitey, 58-year-old, by the way, black gentleman, compassionate release from prison 6 months after she ordered the release of his three co-defendants, known as the Newburgh Four, for similar reasons. The Newburgh Four. Four men from a small river city 60 miles north of New York City convicted of terrorism charges in 2010. Cromitey served 15 years of his 25-year minimum sentence. prosecutors in the case said that Nuremberg defendants spent months scouting targets and securing what they thought were explosives and a surface-to-air missile, aiming to shoot down planes at the Air National Guard base in Nuremberg and blow up synagogues in the Bronx. They were arrested after allegedly planting bombs that were packed with inert explosives supplied by the FBI. Judge McMahon, in her ruling, wrote that the FBI invented the conspiracy and identified the targets. Cromitti and his co-defendants, she wrote, quote, would not have and could not have devised on their own a crime involving missiles that would have warranted the 25-year sentence the court was forced to impose. The notion that Cromitti was selected as a leader by the co-defendants is inconceivable, wrote the judge, given his well-documented buffoonery and ineptitude. In addition, the informant that brought Cromitti into the plot, Shahid Hussein, whose work has been criticized for years by Civil Liberties Group, reports AP, McMahon, the judge, again called their CI, Shahid Hussein, the most unsavory, her words, and a villain sent by the government to, quote, troll among the poorest and weakest of men for, quote unquote, terrorists who might prove susceptible to an offer of much needed cash in exchange for committing a faux crime. Hussein, the same informant, also worked with the FBI on a sting that targeted an Albany, New York pizza shop owner and an imam that involved a loan using money from a fictitious missile sale. Both men who said they were tricked were convicted of money laundering and conspiring to aid a terrorist group. The same confidential informant attracted fresh attention in 2018 when a stretch limo operated by his son for a company that he owned, crashed in rural New York, killing 20 people. His son was convicted of manslaughter, serving 5 to 15. The attorney for Cromitti, I'm obviously thrilled that Mr. Cromitti was released from or will be released from prison, but still believe his conviction was entirely the product of government entrapment. Seeing as he was hounded and manipulated by the government informant way more than any of the other defendants who were previously ordered released, it would have been shocking if McMahon didn't grant our motion. But that's not even the point. Right. To justify your existence, some of these phony patriots, these phony G-men, are entrapping, instigating. Yeah, I mean, I get it. The, no matter if somebody came at me with, you know, some sort of plot like this, it sounds like the FBI cooked up here against these goofs. No one should be susceptible to that, you know, right from wrong. What are you talking about? To surface to air missile and shooting down anything. But that's not the point. That's not living in a free society where, as the judge wrote in her opinion, you're looking and targeting and trying to find the weakest among us who have no capacity, no inclination for that kind of harm and no capacity to accomplish it on their own. But you entrap them so you can put a scalp on your one of the walls of your cubicle and say, you know, I'm out there fighting terrorism. I mean, this is what the FBI has become. And here again, I'm sorry, but like in the Whitmer plot, this is rank and file FBI, like in the raid on the pastor in rural Pennsylvania, but the pro-life activist in rural Pennsylvania. That's rank and file. Or like the targeting by the Richmond office of those Catholics attending Latin Mass, that certainly involved the rank and file. So it's not everybody in the agency. I get it. It's never everybody in any entity that big. But it's more than just a leadership problem.
Yeah, don't forget going after parents who attended school board meetings during COVID.
Well, right. And that, of course, is, comes down from on high. your Attorney General, Merrick Garland. Unbelievable. Right. And again, so this will not get any sort of press. I mean, I hope that these people who've been the Newberg Four, I hope they speak. That will generate a little bit more press. And then you can go to, again, your phony civil libertarian friends who, you know, pretending they're members of an ACLU that has nothing to do with civil liberties anymore either. They're just straight power politics. They will happily concede to the authoritarian practices of federal law enforcement, of the federal government generally. Happily concede if it means that, in the immediacy that Trump is defeated and Biden gets another term, they retain Congress, so on and so forth. They're just partisan hacks. They are just enablers and facilitators of the new Jacobins, the new Marxists, these revolutionaries that have opened the border and drained your bank account. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
That sound means it's time for in-depth history with Frank from Arlington Heights, because there's nothing new in this world. It's just the history we don't know. And Frank has something rather topical, given our recent snow days for school.
Oh,
Frank,
yes.
Frank, take it away.
Good morning. Just last week, schools across the area were shut down and most went to remote learning for a few days. Now, we know this is not ideal instruction, but considering the schoolhouse blizzard of 1888, perhaps it was a good example of using technology for risk avoidance. In that year, Nebraska and the Dakotas, already suffering from a tough early winter, were enjoying a sunny and warmer day on January 12th. Children had returned to school, and many people were out replenishing supplies. This warm-up was illusory, though, as in the early afternoon, a new storm from Canada roared in and engulfed the region in a blizzard, and temperatures dropped up to 80 degrees Fahrenheit in some parts. One brave teen schoolteacher named Minnie Freeman was about to let her young students go home. But when the wind picked up, took out a window, the door blew in, she could see serious trouble ahead. So she quickly decided to lead 13 schoolchildren to a local farmhouse 3/4 of a mile away in the face of what was now a blinding snowstorm. She used some twine from the classroom and tied the children together to have them walk, and even carried one of them to her host family's house. All 13 survived, and this is memorialized in the Nebraska Capitol today as a mural. Many others, though, were not so lucky, as this horrible storm claimed 235 dead, including many school children. Thankfully, the pioneering Miss Freeman was able to keep her wits about her and save these kids. If she had lived in a more brainwashed era, like today, and had to rely on something as laughable as an EV bus in the winter, the story might have turned out differently.
Frank, that was lovely.
An interesting side note to that, that a kid that Minnie Freeman picked up and carried to that farmhouse in Nebraska in 1888, you know who that was?
Who?
I do not. I did not get that deep into it.
That was Warren Buffett.
Really?
Now, I'm making that up. 1888? No, obviously not.
Warren Buffett's great-grandpa.
Great-great-great-grandpa.
Right. He is like 95.
No, I know, but he's not. Yeah, he's not 135, though. Yeah, very good.
Well, that was wonderful, Frank. Thank you
Frank, as always, bringing the past to the present. Very good. Appreciate it.
All right, have a good day. Be safe.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Donald Trump has been typically entertaining on the stump, including in New Hampshire over the weekend. This riff on building an Iron Dome over the United States, a la Israel, you know, some of his best work with full Michael Winslow sound effects. It's Take a listen.
And I will build an iron dome over our country, a state-of-the-art missile defense shield made in the USA. We do it for other countries. We help other countries. We don't do it for ourselves. We need it, too. You know, Reagan proposed that many years ago, Star Wars. He proposed it many, many years ago, but at that time there was no technology. It was just like it looked good. But we have unbelievable technology. We shoot them down. I've seen so many things. I've seen shots that you wouldn't even believe. Missile launched. They go, missile launched. And you hear a bell go. I mean, I see this. It's so incredible. And these guys, these geniuses, they go, these are not muscle guys here. They're muscle guys up here, right? And they calmly walk to a seat. Ding, 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 ding. They've only got 17 seconds to figure this whole thing out, right? Boom. Okay. Missile launch. Ping, boom. It's the most and we don't have it here. But we help other countries in having it. No, we're going to have the greatest Iron Dome. Let's call it Iron Dome. Anywhere in the world. And it's going to be manufactured. A lot of it right here in New Hampshire, actually. Uh-huh. Come to think of it.
Bing, bing, dong.
I think, he was watching airplane movies or watching his grandson play Space Invaders or something. I don't know. So, again, this is one of those instances where you say, you know, Trump is directionally correct, but he's not necessarily the details guy.
He's
just
excited
sort of
about it.
Get it done. But, he's definitely... Definitely, whatever he witnessed really stuck with him. For more on Trump, because that guy you just heard is the bete noire of all of our bettors who were assembled in Davos for the World Economic Forum last week, as we discussed at some length and continue to. Kevin Roberts was one of those at Davos. And again, as we talked a little bit about his remarks yesterday with Jed Babin, you know, I mean, I think, you know, Javier Milei, just because it was such a Econ 101 Friedrich Hayek lesson for the assembled globalists. But right there, you know, just maybe just a half a step below Milei in terms of a rhetorical dressing down to those in Davos was Kevin Roberts from the Heritage Foundation. Kevin, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Always glad to be with you, Dan and Amy. What a glorious and brilliant clip from President Trump.
Yes.
It's a doozy. Yeah.
Hey, the Joint Chiefs of Staff meetings must have been, you know, wildly entertaining. I can only imagine. Really took it to those in Davos who, parroting what you hear from Biden and company in this country, have great fear of a MAGA dictatorship and see themselves as the great vanguards for small d democracy. And you had something to say about that to them, which was nice.
Well, I did have something to say to them. I was a little reluctant to go because I knew I would be outnumbered like 3,000 to 1, or I guess because President Milei was there, 3,000 to 2.
Right.
But I went on behalf of the average American, right? And they absolutely abhor, the people at Davos, absolutely abhor not just President Trump, but any of us who deign to challenge their desire to continue to concentrate wealth and power. So I had a great time telling them the truth. I also had a great time watching a few of them just totally melt down in the audience because they can't handle the truth.
Yeah, well, the truth that you gave them was wide ranging. I mean, it was top line, but wide ranging, covered a number of topics, including their, you know, all these great small L liberal, small D Democrats that like to defer the policymaking for the world to Chinese communists. You made mention of that. And of course, the other feature topic always in Davos, at least in the last decade, is the climate apocalypse, and you had comments on both of those topics.
Right, and you think about Davos, it's hypocrisy layered on top of hypocrisy, and the two examples you just mentioned, Dan, China and their religion, which is climate change, actually go hand in hand as hypocrisies, as you know well. And in particular, what the point that I tried to drive home to them was, how is it that on the one hand you can tell us that climate change is happening and the world's going to end in the next 10 years, which you've been telling us, by the way, for the last 40. So that's one point. But how can you continue to tell us that on the one hand? But then on the other hand, invite the Chinese Communist Party which initiates the greatest pollution in the world. They're basically not signatories to your revered Bible agreement, the Paris Agreement. And on top of their human rights abuses, you give them a platform at Davos. It tells me that maybe something else is your goal, and that something else that is their goal, Dan, is to take power away from America. Why do they want to do that? Because America is the icon for freedom and self-governance, and that's ultimately what they want to destroy.
Did you learn anything from your time there?
I learned that the World Economic Forum is as bad as you would expect, but that's about it.
Really? Yeah.
Maybe
that,
worse.
Did you have time to
be worse?
Did you have time to, you know, have a scotch with Klaus Schwab by chance, or no? Was he unavailable?
You know, I would have sort of enjoyed that, because I would have enjoyed telling the man eyeball to eyeball what I thought, but I didn't run into him. I didn't spend a whole lot of time at the conference itself, because I didn't want any of that to seep into my DNA. But I did almost literally run into John Kerry as I was exiting on Thursday. Oh. And after Mr. Schwab, Mr. Kerry, of course, is considered like the hero of the World Economic Forum. So maybe another time, but not this time.
Yeah, I have to go back to at least, you know, the clips. Speeches I watched in full, or remarks I watched in full, were yours and Milei's. But I saw clips of some of the others, Kerry's daughter. But this woman who founded a group called Stop Ecocide Now, who wants ecocide to be defined as a criminal action. So if you harm the environment, as she defines it, you know, given thinking about the kind of statutory language she would include under the charge of ecocide, then you should be held accountable before a criminal court. I mean, potentially imprisoned. And she specifically mentions, I mean, she just met, you know, people like farmers and fishermen are some of the worst offenders of ecocide. So you have serious people listening, well, allegedly serious people, but highly educated, wealthy, powerful. They're, you know, part of the administrative states and all these Western countries, listening to somebody, and probably most of them nodding their heads, talking about locking up farmers and fishermen for ecocide, and apparently they're just completely oblivious to what we've seen in terms of revolts from farmers in places like the Netherlands, in places like Germany, what we saw in Canada. I mean, the what you said, you just can't put enough exclamation points behind the idea of the disdain they have for people that they see as their lessers, the rabble.
No, it's so true, Dan, and it reminds me of Amy's good question about, you know, what did I learn? Well, I learned that, I mean, they actually believe these things. I mean, the three of us can have this conversation. I'm sure most of your audience are saying, come on, I mean, the ecocide, they don't really believe this. Oh, they do. And when they say that, those of us who have children, those of us who like farmers, those of us, including myself, who like to fish.
Like to eat.
We are all like to eat.
I like meat.
You know, yeah. You know, by the way, I should just say I celebrated, you know, my own abuse of ecocide by having a really big steak in Davos. After
Oh, good.
Nice.
But the real point is they want to end agriculture across the world. I mean, that came out of John Kerry's mouth. And obviously that hurts all of us. It particularly right now, this year, as we're going into the spring, hurts farmers in places like Germany and the Netherlands and Ireland. And ultimately, to sum up here, that kind of agenda is coming here if the left continues to win elections in this country. That's not alarmism. And so America is, in fact, one of the last best hopes to stand up against Davos. And I guess ultimately I'm glad that I went, not just to read them the riot act, but to see firsthand that they really do believe this nonsense about things such as ecocide.
Well, when you were speaking, what was their reaction in the crowd? Like, what kind of facial expressions were they making?
A lot of crying.
Oh, Amy, it was glorious. They were, there were audible gasps anytime I talked about climate change or China. And one European guy in some skinny jeans just had a total meltdown in the front row. It was glorious.
That was no European in skinny jeans. That was John Kerry, Kevin.
If only.
Yeah. So any reflection on the migrant issue among the elites there? Anybody noticing what's happening in Western Europe and the Western world and saying maybe the open borders paradigm is not the right one? Any conversations like that occur that you saw or heard?
Well, there were conversations, but they were all defensive. And I'm glad you asked that question for this reason. They are the organizers of the World Economic Forum are realizing that they've got to back up a little bit, for example, on their ESG agenda. They're not going to back up on the climate change alarmism, but they realize that the reaction to the environmental social governance stuff has been very successful, so they're backing up. I think they will eventually back up a little bit on their embrace of the Chinese Communist Party. But to your question, they do not understand the backlash that's occurring because of migration. I mean, I had some sidebar conversations with some of the attendees just to ask that question, and they simply don't understand, A, the scale of the problem just in terms of social cohesion and economics, but they don't understand the political cataclysm that is going to befall any political movement, including the British Conservatives, for not addressing the problem. And I mean, frankly, just to be really blunt here, there's going to be political hell to pay on these elites in the coming years. Unfortunately, it's going to be after all this damage is done from open borders.
Yeah, it's sort of like listening to people saying we should imprison farmers. I mean, the protesting you see in the streets in places like Dublin, that has not made an impression on you? You think that's just a few right wing extremists promoting white supremacy or something? I mean, is that what they think, that there's just like real regular people, our kind of people, have no concerns about this? I mean, are they able to read polling on this? I mean, it's not particularly obtuse how unpopular the open borders position is and how much chaos it's inflicted.
Well, it ought to be pretty simple to them. But in fact, they believe that they can ignore it, and they can count on their allies in the media to help them ignore it, to obscure that these protests are happening. And when the news sort of penetrates the consciousness of average people in places like Ireland and the UK, they then, to your point, Dan, portray the reactions of being by people who really are like knuckle draggers. I mean, they think that it's impossible for someone who's reacting to these open borders to actually be a rational, thinking, normal human being. That's one of the biggest disconnects that exists, and that, frankly, I saw firsthand in multiple conversations there.
Mm-hmm. One other point I thought was interesting. Emma Tucker, who's the editor-in-chief of the Wall Street Journal, in this roundtable about the media, essentially conceded that the legacy brands like her outlet, the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, you know which ones they are, the legacy brands don't have the sort of control over information flow that they used to have. Now, she said this, you know, wistfully. She wasn't not ecstatic about it, but she's telling the truth regardless, even if it's a truth she's not happy to confront. So that's some good news coming out of there, too. I mean, it's good news, bad news. They recognize they don't have that control, but it's control they seek. And this, you know, and so the next stage is the social media companies, the tech oligarchs colluding with these legacy brands to try to marginalize other information outlets. That would be my fear. What's yours?
Yeah, I think that's the precise fear. And they're even better at it. Tech oligarchs than are the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, so that ought to be really concerning. And I'll tell you a story of the week prior to going to Davos. I was meeting with a couple dozen House Republicans here in D.C. about the way forward on the border and some bills. This is all connected to what you said. And one of them said, well, Kevin, you know, I'm a little less worried about the tech oligarchs. And this is a good guy. And I said, well, I'm not sure why you would say that, because as we sit here, you're running for reelection. And they're 99 times, you're 99 times more likely to have a fundraising email sent into a spam filter because of the tech oligarchs than a Democrat colleague. And I said, this is just one example, obviously just in the political sphere. The rest of us out here in kind of the normal world encounter this just utter condescension, including by Emma Tucker of the Journal, that they want to control us. And therefore, to sum up here, even though the Journal and the Times see that their influence over us is waning, to your point, Dan, they are going to lean. They are leaning on their friends, the tech oligarchs, to continue to control us. We as people, you think about solution, we have to be a lot more cognizant of what we consume. And that fracturing of where we get our news, while the powers that be lament it, ultimately we celebrate it. Y'all celebrate it with what you do. I celebrate it here at Heritage. And we have to do more of that. It's really important that we consume from outlets that don't hate us.
Kevin Roberts, President, Heritage Foundation. Kevin, thank you as always.
Thanks, Dan and Amy. Always a pleasure. Take care.
Thanks. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Insert Democrat socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House floor for 30-plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. Gang. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when. You're moving out. I said, when you're moving out.
Mm-hmm. Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. That theme music means it's time for our weekly confab with Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints, wirepoints.org, all things Illinois policy related. Back in December, we brought you this story that was penned by reporters for Block Club Chicago, looking at some of the politically connected developers, real estate developers. Is there any other kind than the politically connected? Not if you want to do business in the city. That the politically connected real estate developers that were the property owners of buildings being used by the city to house migrants. Phil Denny, owner of Peppercorn Capital, the self-proclaimed king of the West Loop. And that's how he refers to himself, self-proclaimed. Thus,
does he wear a crown around?
I don't know.
He should.
A.G. Hollis, investor, MAB Capital Management. And Scott Goodman, founding principal of Fairpoint Development, also a leader of the team picked by the city to redevelop the Michael Reese Hospital site. So basically the gist of it, without getting too much into the numbers, is that the properties these guys own, they were receiving well above market rents for housing migrants. Particularly in an environment where this just in, commercial office space is not exactly enjoying the salad days. So a little bit of new information on Scott Goodman, who apparently, this is Fairpoint, apparently also is the owner of the warehouse at 2341 South Halsted, where that five-year-old kid died. Scott Goodman is charging the city of Chicago. This is some legwork that was done by a friend of mine. Goodman is charging the city of Chicago $60 a square foot to lease his property. To put that in perspective, the nicest office building in Chicago, Chicago River Point, is leasing at $53 a square foot.
Oh, my goodness.
The average price of an industrial lease in Chicago is $10 a square foot, and these properties are zoned as industrial. The city of Chicago is paying about $16.5 million a year for shelters to Scott Goodman. That's just one of them. You know, that's just one of the guys. Prior to the lucrative city contract, the three industrial buildings sat unleased for 5 to 7 years. They were unleased for 5 or 7 years, and now they're under contract with the city at these prices.
Well, who came up with those prices? That's exorbitant, ridiculous amount of money.
344 North Ogden,
yeah,
106,000 square feet, $6.3 million annually, the lease. 1308 North Halsted, 84,000 square feet, $5 million annually. 2341 South Halstead, 86,000 square feet, $5.1 million annually. Those are the leases. There's your $16.5 a year, just for those three properties. By the way, my friend also noted that Goodman, this politically connected real estate developer, failed to pay his 2022 property taxes of $180,000 at the shelter being used at 1308 North Elston.
He had the money to do it, didn't he?
He does now, or he will. How's the city? But the question is, well, how's the city of Chicago renting from a landlord who's delinquent on his property taxes? Well, you know, professional courtesy.
Probably.
That's where things are at in the city. Now maybe you understand the source of some of BLM Brandon's panic attacks, if those reports are true, when this information gets more widely distributed. And with a recalcitrant Governor Jelly Boy who is not helping him facilitate migrants out of the city into the suburbs, which I understand is what he really wants to see happen.
Right. And yesterday, Mayor Johnson told older people that there will be no more new migrant shelters set up in Chicago. And Governor Pritzker, that was news to him.
I'm deeply concerned. We do not have enough shelter as it is in the city of Chicago. The city has not told the state where they would like us to put our resources to build new shelters or help them build new shelters. So we can't help if they don't identify those locations. And we need to make sure that we're not ending shelter capacity, as the city is now planning to do, at the end of winter. If you think this problem is going to end when the temperature warms up, it's not. We still need shelter for people. So I'm deeply concerned, and I'm hoping that at least the plan that I read this morning, actually in your column.
Right hand's not talking to the left hand. But, you know, Mayor Johnson rescheduled that migrant meeting with the Chicago mayors, or Chicago area mayors. 275 originally invited. 30 showed up yesterday. They went from the United Center just to the mayor's office, and it was via Zoom. But no word yet on what was accomplished and if any suburban mayors agreed to take any migrants.
Well, why isn't Jelly Belly helping out? I'm listening to the buck passing in that clip you just heard. Why is he helping out?
Well, when I asked him that last press conference, I said, we have 102 counties. Why can't we spread this out? He's like, they've already been traumatized enough, Amy, these migrants are put on buses where they don't know where they're going. I said, that's not true. They know exactly where they're going. But that was, he's like, they're coming here. We don't want to disrupt their lives anymore.
Yeah, that's all really interesting. The point is that what you're seeing happening is they're not getting along. BLM Brandon wants him to facilitate migrants out in the suburbs. He doesn't want to do it, so he's pretending like they have no look-see at the plans or the lack thereof going on in the city, and they're just sort of innocent bystanders. You're the governor. You got a regional problem. Whether they all get moved to the city or some peel off in the suburbs or whatever, you're the governor, big boy. I'm really concerned about this and I'm concerned about that. I could give a rat's ass about what you're concerned about. Your concerns don't amount to anything with respect to people's quality of life. So what are you going to do about it, big talker? Forget BLM Brandon for a second. Don't let Spalding get away with his routine again. BLM Brandon is an easy target. Aim at the bigger one. For more on this, Ted, thanks for joining us as always. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning, guys. Well, you know, Pritzker says the migrant crisis won't end when it gets warm, and I think this battle between Pritzker and Johnson won't end anytime soon. I predict it's going to get a lot worse. You're right. Johnson is an easy target. But also, Pritzker hates how Johnson does things, in my opinion. You know, Pritzker's very competent in being incompetent. Whereas Johnson is just incompetent.
So, Pritzker is competent at being incompetent. Yeah, that is a good way to put it. No, he puts this, you know, I'm so earnest and I'm so concerned face on being the presider over a failing mob economy. He's tweeting out celebratory notes about the record sales in cannabis and the money coming in from the casino in the fiscal benefits of our bipartisan gaming bill coming to Danville, right? Gambling, abortion, payday loans, and drugs, and you know it's great.
Drug sales are great.
It's fantastic, and I'll tell you, I want to comment on the money you were talking about being spent on the migrant shelters. And this Scott Goodman, who I haven't followed him, but you know we're trying to do our homework on all this money being spent, and we've got some FOIA results coming in, and also just access to what the state publishes. And you know I think it's going to reveal some things. It's hard for us to pinpoint where this money goes, but there are these massive number of grants, right? So you're talking about all this millions of dollars that Pritzker's doled out. 160 million promised, plus all the health care spending and all that. You know, we're well over
a billion, right? Now. Yeah, right.
Yeah, easy. I mean, easy. And but so you start opening up these, you know, you start clicking, you start getting all these grants. God knows, there's so much money being flowing to all these different groups. You'll never know what the accountability of that was. And you got to know, just like in this case of you know, these $60 per square foot rents. You got to know that this money is just flowing everywhere and buying off all kinds of people or enriching a lot of people. But unfortunately, this kind of government, we don't know. In this mob economy, as you called it, we have no idea how this money is being spent.
Well, here's where they want to go as well, too. This is talk about he's competent at being incompetent. I like that phrase, talking about Governor Spaulding. The Department of Human Services is looking to cut $87 million in funding for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So let me understand something. And I can't believe this is a fight that Jelly Boy wants to pick, probably just happening, you know, unbeknownst to him, you know, sort of like whatever is happening below his belt is unbeknownst to him. $87 million cut to funding for social service providers who serve the people with intellectual and developmental disabilities against the backdrop of what you just said. More than $1 billion spent on migrants so far. And Jelly Belly standing before the docile Chicago press corps. Oh, I'm concerned about this. And he's got to give us a plan to see if we can invest more. We got to build more migrant, blah, blah. Right. All this and then all the talk, as always happens. Are you listening, all you liberal magpies in the suburbs? Good grief! They're looking to $87 million. I mean that $87 million in the state budget is chump change. But just the fact this is how indifferent they are truly to the truly vulnerable, while they're playing their politics with everybody else's money, trying to backfill the population of Illinois so we don't lose another congressional seat or two next census.
Yeah, and then of course, you know, Johnson wants to raise taxes for, you know, quote, homelessness. Again, you know, another $100 million purportedly. It's another tax hike, and he wants to do it on the real estate, which we talked about, you know, what the doom loop that it's in. So again, that's the craziness too, right? So we take tons of money, spend it on migrants that aren't citizens, and then we turn around, raise taxes, and hurt the very city we're pretending that we're trying to help, and it's a, you know, it's a cluster.
The people who voted for this guy, and vote for all those legislators down there, I mean, they cannot be held in low enough repute. They cannot be deserving of too much scorn. It is so noxious. The billions and the moral preening, and you're going to lecture me, and you're turn around and you're going to try and take some relatively modest amount of money, but not modest to those social service providers, away from service providers who make a little bit above minimum wage, most of the frontline workers. I know I've got some experience in this sector, and are doing, frankly, the work that the state has no capacity to do. Not to mention the promises that were made and made every freaking cycle by these same politicians. These people are so despicable, it is difficult to put into words. And the people who support them, and I hope this is, you know, radiating out, I hope it motivates some people to communicate this, are as slimy and disgusting and barbaric as the politicians they support. It could not be more stark. If it wasn't stark enough before, it's I don't know what else brings it home than the billions being spent on people in this country illegally, some of whom are doing the residents of Illinois harm. And you're cutting $87 million from families, who have a family member with an intellectual developmental disability. I mean, that is Illinois in a nutshell.
I think the chaos is just starting, Dan. You know, we're going to have to, in theory, kick out these migrant shelters. That's going to create a lot of chaos as well, right? Because, in February 1st, it's going to be warmer. They have no plan. They have no idea. And what we just have to watch is kind of continue to self-destruct.
Well, I mean, you know, look, I don't want Scott Goodman to lose his sweetheart leases. That's what's important. Yeah. Scum.
Yeah, it's a good
scum.
Deal.
Scum. These people. All right. On a happier note, how was your school choice event last night with Ian Rowe?
Hey, Dan, we talk about a lot of the problems, but I tell you, it's really inspiring. Ian Rowe and what he's done in the South Bronx with school choice. You know, he told us about taking on the unions. He told us about how they had 11,000 people march over, I forget which bridge, one of the big bridges. They've done a great job of motivating people to push back and fight back against the unions, something we haven't done a good enough job of here. Really inspiring. And then we also had Preston Kendall from Cristo Rey Schools and Jennifer Burns from Classical Consortium Academy. And I tell you, just to be with leaders, with innovators, with people who are not willing to lower the bar, but willing to talk about faith and family and virtues in school, it felt really good. It was a great, great event.
Todd Dabrowski, President of WirePoints, WirePoints.org, all things Illinois policy related. Thanks for indulging my ranting, Ted. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. More the hijinks from that important investigative body. It was bipartisan, don't you know? I'm talking about the J6 Star Chamber, lorded over by Benny Thompson and facilitated with Republican Quislings, Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney. Digital forensics team employed by the House Administration Subcommittee and Oversight discovered a data deletion that occurred on January 1st of 2023. Oh, interesting. Data deletion in terms of the information called together by the J6 committee that was to be turned over to the new leadership in the House. They're trying to recover 117 encrypted files that the House Select J6 Committee deleted before Republicans took the majority last year. Morgan Griffith, Republican from Virginia, saying the reports are accurate. Unfortunately, we cannot determine what was in the deleted files. They're attempting to do that at present. No, you know, the purveyors of transparency, these patriotic fact finders, we're told, and we were witness to in prime time, you might recall, during that Torquemada-like performance of that committee.
Right. Yes, uh-huh. They set aside The Bachelor for this one night on a Thursday, yes.
Why is this important? It's important, well, it's important on a number of levels, just in terms of the scams your government runs on you. That's number one. But why is it important in this time, even though that has since been passed? Because that's the entire campaign of the Democrat Party. Democrat Socialist. That was the Biden speech at Valley Forge. That was the Biden speech in Charleston. Then his surrogates were dispatched to go on the talk shows to repeat what he read at Valley Forge and Charleston. It's the whole thing. Save our democracy versus MAGA dictatorship. And the J6 committee is supposed to be the part of the evidentiary body that compels your support for Joe Biden, the American people's support for Joe Biden, to prevent this insurrectionist crowd from seizing control of the federal government and ending a representative republic. That's the line they're selling. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Scott McKay. Scott, of course, is the publisher of The Hayride. He's also a contributing editor at American Spectator, an author of Racism, Revenge, and Ruin, which focuses on our very own native son, Barack Obama. Scott, thanks for joining us as always. Appreciate it.
Dan, Amy, it's always a pleasure, and today is no exception.
Today is a primary day in New Hampshire. How exciting. What do you anticipate will happen today and then tomorrow in terms of whether or not this Republican primary campaign continues in a significant way or not?
Well, there's a Suffolk poll out, and I guess it's a tracking poll. And it has Trump at 60 and Haley at 38. I think that might be a little high for Haley, except I know there's going to be a lot of Democrats who cross over and vote in that primary. And that's going to, I think, inflate the amount of support that Haley has. I don't know what she's going to do, maybe mid-30s, I guess. And that probably is enough to keep her going, at least for a little while longer. But what I would expect is once we get into the closed primaries, which you start to see after South Carolina, it's gonna be really patently obvious that Haley is not a factor of any great note within the Republican primaries. And I think at that point, the money will dry up and she'll have to get out. You know, she had 19% in Iowa, and she had to get Democrat crossover votes to get that. And she spent more money in Iowa than anybody else, which should tell you something. I don't think she has much of a constituency within the party. I think her constituency is the mainstream media, which is what Mitt Romney and John McCain's constituency was. The difference is you actually have somebody who represents the rest of the party, which is two-thirds, three-quarters, four-fifths of Republican voters.
So this, Sorry for interrupting, but the South Carolina primary is about a month away. So you think she's going to last even if she loses, which she's going to come in second place, obviously, at a two-horse race. She'll stay in it until after South Carolina?
I mean, she might not, but she's going to have the money to do that. So it wouldn't surprise me if she stuck around. And what you can really look for is a whole bunch of brand new, quote unquote, damaging revelations about Trump to kick in after New Hampshire, where they just kind of pour the kitchen sink out and see if that'll shake Republican voters off Trump, which it won't, because at this point, you know, I think that for the most part, the Republican electorate has an emotional bond with Trump by now. And like, they're just not listening. And they probably shouldn't, because the people that are going to make negative accusations against Trump burned through their credibility a long time ago, especially with Republican voters. And so, like, I think this thing is baked into the cake. And the question is, will the donor class and the GOP establishment respect and accept the fact that the party's electorate has moved on from them?
Some moved on from some of them. But the other thing that's happening concurrent, though, is, and you've seen it in New Hampshire especially, is you just have like a parade of Republican office holders trekking up to New Hampshire to stand with Trump on the dais. I mean, including some candidates who have now gotten out of the race, like Ramaswamy and Scott. And it's like this becomes a snowball rolling downhill where you have Republican Party regulars, those with titles, trekking up, like I said, to New Hampshire and otherwise announcing their endorsements of Trump. I mean, it's so that this whole thing seems, the idea that this race would continue in any meaningful way after today just seems difficult to conjure.
Well, I don't disagree with you on that. And yet I'm looking at Washington and you have Republican senators trying to do an immigration, comprehensive immigration deal with Democrats. Yeah. And it's like, how out of touch could you possibly get? That's literally the only way that the Republicans can lose in 2024, and they're actively attempting to do it. And so you can call that treason or sabotage or whatever you want to call it, but like these guys do what they do, and they're a little bit like Obama Democrats in that they don't give up. You know, they're different from Obama Democrats in that Obama Democrats find a way to win a lot, whereas Bush establishment Republicans find a way to lose constantly and yet keep, I can't even say keep fighting, they keep existing.
Well, what about Mike Johnson, since he hails from your general vicinity? You know, I mean, it's one thing to dismiss what Lankford and those Quislings and Republicans in the Senate are doing. But Mike Johnson, you know, we understand the narrow majority he has, and we understand he's got some big spenders in that caucus, and he's got some weak knees in that caucus. But is he aggressive enough on this issue in saying, essentially, we're not doing anything until you do HR 2 or at least give us Remain in Mexico? We're just everything is shut down until that happens.
Yeah.
That's where the party is. And that's not where he is.
Well, he is in probably the classic no win situation because he cannot get to 218 votes with aggressive enforcement. They passed HR 2, which would constitute aggressive enforcement, and the Senate won't take it up. So he's in this kind of shutdown politics scenario, which never benefits or favors the Republicans for the simple reason that he can't get his group to stand together. And so I don't know where his room to move comes from now. You know, he's had to do a CR because he's trying to get the budget to regular order, and he can't do that with the 2024 budget. He has to start it with the 25 budget because that's what he was left with by McCarthy. And he keeps losing political capital with every CR he does, but he doesn't have another option. And then you have this, you know, the Ukraine funding and the border and all this kind of stuff, and he's getting absolutely no help whatsoever from Mitch McConnell, which he has to have, because if the Republicans in the Senate sell out to Schumer, then Johnson's all alone with basically half of the House. And he got his negotiating leverage is nil. So he can stand on principle and nothing happens. And the flow of migrants across the border just keeps on going. So I don't know. I don't know that there's any fix for any of this until after the 24 election, you know, if then.
Well, Abbott should take all the illegals that are coming into his state and send them to D.C., Delaware, or the steps of the Supreme Court. You're like, okay, you wanted
That's
this.
Exactly
Here
right.
you go.
No.
What are you going to do now?
No, it's not exactly right. What he should do is Mike Johnson should stand on principle, like you just said, and those migrants should be sent to members of his caucus who are unwilling to go to the mat on this. That's what should be happening.
He could do that.
That's where it belongs.
Well, I had an American Spectator column this morning that said exactly that. If you turn D.C. into a giant refugee camp and they're housing people in, you know, all of the clubs and hotels and apartment buildings where members of Congress are, you might actually get a little bit of movement on this issue, because generally speaking, Washington simply is not listening on this. And I think it's because they're more than happy to have regular Americans feel the pain of this so long as they don't. And until you find a way to make these people feel their own pain as a result of their policies, you're not going to get any solution to this at all. But we do know that, you know, sending migrants to Martha's Vineyard and Chicago and some of these other places, that actually does get people's attention. So I think they do need to go to Washington from now on.
Put a big white tent on the mall.
Yeah, and they sent him to Kamala Harris's front steps, and that doesn't move the policy. You're not going to move the open borders crowd, that you're, because you're not their constituency, and they don't care. I mean, how much clearer could that be? But Republicans, what they do a terrible job at doing, per what's happening with the Senate right now, as you were just describing, and what frustrates people about Republicans, I'll speak for myself, I know it, in a Republican Party that destroyed itself in my home state of Illinois, is policing themselves. You know, it's easy to do the whole Brandon Johnson and Pritzker and Eric Adams and Hochul and on down the line. How about the enemies inside your perimeter? How about when you have the majority in the House, as the Republicans do, you say, look, this is a red line, to borrow a phrase, and this is what we have to do. And if it costs me the speakership because we've got big spenders and open border sympathizers in the caucus, oh, well, then it does. But if we're ever going to stand on principle on something, this is the moment to do it. The other side couldn't be more upside down. The regular people in this country are finally focused on this because of what Abbott and to a lesser extent DeSantis have done. And so let's take advantage of it and let's demonstrate to the American people that there really is a choice and that it's not just a rhetorical one, that we're actually committed to this and we will go to the mat on this for them. That's what Trump would do if he was in office.
I would love it if every member of that delegation would take to heart what you just said, because maybe you could get somewhere. But look, Mitch McConnell is the caucus leader for the GOP in the Senate, and he's half dead, okay? And the guy has done nothing but engineer defeats for the party since 2007, and those people over there do not have the stones to make a move on him and get rid of him.
I understand.
And until you have that, everything that we're talking about here is, I don't want to say performative, but it's you know, you're talking about how good you are, but you can't make policy unless McConnell is pushed out and somebody with a little bit more of a affinity for the GOP's position takes over in his place. And that's the problem right now is the Senate, I think.
Well, I agree that's the problem in the Senate. But, yeah, I mean, look, if 80% of popular support for your position is not enough leverage to wage war, right, then I don't know what is, you know?
I know. Right now, I don't know that there's a solution to this problem when you have these entrenched, I wouldn't even say out of touch. It's not that a guy like a McConnell is out of touch. He's actively engaged in sabotaging his own voting base.
Well, right. So send, I mean, this is my point. So, hey, Abbott, send migrants to Oklahoma. Send them to Jim Lankford's office. Send them to his hometown. Send them to his neighborhood. That's my point.
Yeah.
Now you're really cooking with fire.
One busload of migrants that shows up in on the street in front of Mitch McConnell's office in I don't know where his
Lexington
main,
or wherever
office
yeah,
is
right.
Lexington yeah and you know, all of a sudden you're going to have certainly the whole state of Kentucky is going to go into a media frenzy mode.
Exactly.
And McConnell's got to say something from that. Problem is, you didn't elect a Republican governor over there, so you can't maximize it, because what will happen is, Andy Beshear is going to talk about how the Republicans don't care about the people of Kentucky and all this kind of stuff. And then it goes off in that direction. But I'd still do it. Sure, why not? It's one busload of migrants. It's a symbolic thing. And then send the rest to D.C. and drop them off at the Rayburn Building? That's where the Senate offices is. Drop them off there.
Scott McKay, publisher of The Hayride, contributing editor, American Spectator, author of his new book, Racism, Revenge, and Ruin. Scott, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
Thanks. You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Was it not días cuando tiran, a veces los días jueves, a veces hay días ahora que tienen la gente la basura.
My children go out every day searching for food. They go to the garbage dump every day, especially on Thursdays when we have seen cars and trucks bringing the trash from other cities. Many times they just don't find anything, so they come back empty-handed, and we just sit here and pray to God that the next day we'll have something, and on that day we only drink water.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Of course, that's part of the impetus for the Food for the Poor campaign that we do and did this past holiday season, and we've extended it into the new year, offering a few more business benefactor opportunities in particular. For more on where our fundraising stands, our campaign stands, of course, this is in Chicago, but it's company-wide, Salem Broadcasting. We're just trying to do our part here in the Chicago market. We're pleased to be joined again by Anitra Parmalee, who is with a fundraiser for Food for the Poor. Anitra, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
2024 with an extraordinary impact. We're talking about a one-time gift of $160, providing four children like those of the mother you just heard. Four children will receive food for a year. A business benefactor gift of $2,500 provides 62 children. Dan, I mean, I'm a visual person, so I'm thinking of two classrooms like your children or your grandchildren attend. Two classrooms will eat for a year. I mean, that's extraordinary. That's something to circle this date on your calendar.
There's no question. And you know, just with respect to how the campaign went this holiday season, I think people would like an understanding of how much progress we made. You know, again, the sort of the need is almost infinite, but how much progress we made, how many people there participating and helping by partnering with Food for the Poor through us.
Well, literally thousands of children and hundreds of families got the news that they are going to have food for a year. And when you put yourself into their situation, these are mothers and fathers who are today waking up and they have no hope because of a lack of jobs and runaway food prices. And the tail end of COVID distancing has broken the back of the local economy. They have nowhere to turn except to the listeners of AM 560, except to your listeners. And already, as I said, thousands of children have been moved from hunger into knowing they're going to have food for a year, moved from darkness into light. They have known that it's because of God. Yeah, Amy.
You know, and how quickly, you know, just in sort of the mechanics of this, how quickly does if somebody's donation, somebody joining a business benefactor program today, for example, how quickly does that translate into the notification and the delivery of life-saving food?
Well, you can imagine when lives are hanging on the balance, it's instantaneous. Because of technology, I am actually watching the gifts come in right this moment. So we are keeping our project managers, our partners in the ground, the ministers, the pastors on the ground up to date. Because to be blunt, we brought a long list to your listeners. And as we have been checking off those names, we have relied on the generosity. So it really is, because of technology, it is almost instantaneous. We can see exactly how many families are going to eat for a year because of your listeners' generosity.
And let's talk about our business benefactor program. We have a lot of business benefactors that were so gracious. They made a one-time donation of $2,500 as a way of saying thank you. We're giving them 41-minute commercials. You can already hear some of their commercials that are airing right here. And if you listen to this station, we ask you to please support them because of their generous donation. Applied Mechanical Sales, Reliable Plating, Grace Lutheran Church in Streamwood, Favia Family Dental, that's my dentist in Arlington Heights, Birdies for Kids, Dutch Farms. But we still have some openings, and if you own a business or make the marketing decisions for your company, this is the time to act. This is a way to take your business to the next level while still helping people in need, children who need to eat. I mean, the starvation, folks, it is real and it is serious. And people die, children die every year because they don't have enough food or water or medicine, and food for the poor can make a difference. So the number to call, her name is Ann Jeanette, by the way. The number to call is 847-472-8951. That's 847-472-8951, or visit 560theanswer.com/food for the poor. But let's talk about that $2,500. I mean, you mentioned it's a class, two classrooms full of kids that could eat for an entire year.
And talk about return on investment. I mean, we are so grateful for our partnership with AM 560, with your show. So many people, when they go to 560theanswer.com and click on that red Give Life banner, or as you said, call Ann Jeanette, they're expressing their joy that not only are they advancing their business and exposing their specific business and the amazing values they offer, but also to recognize that because of our partnership with the station, they are also changing the lives of 62 children. I mean, imagine if it's like an elementary school playground. You know, imagine all of those children, listless, lethargic. Amy, you've seen it yourself. These are not the children we're accustomed to seeing. The malnutrition has just stolen their future as well as their present. But because of your gift right now, of any size, whether you're able to come in as a business partner at $2,500, or if you're able to give a gift of $80 and rescue two children, the impact is phenomenal. All of a sudden, the hair is no longer red because of malnutrition. All of a sudden, they have hope and a future. There's laughter. There's mischievousness. As a parent, imagine longing for your children to be up to something because you know it means that they're getting proper nutrition. I mean, the impact is incredible. And we're so grateful to everybody who's already stepped up as a business benefactor. Your food is even now being distributed in the name of your business, in the name of your commitment, not just to see your business get the recognition that it needs, but also to change the lives of 62 children. I mean, amazing. $2,500, 62 children eating two meals a day for a year. I mean, that is some God-drenched math.
And, you know, is there any sense of urgency? I mean, the obvious sense of urgency is people are on the brink of starvation. But is there any sense of urgency just in terms of the timing, the logistics, you know, seasonal weather in places like Haiti that are being served, you know, where, you know, you guys have this mapped out. You've got the calendar. You've got the transportation issues figured out. But just in terms of we need to get, you know, X amount of dollars in to feed X amount of people. And we've got these windows of maximum opportunity. You know what I mean?
Oh, exactly. Because today we are asking you, inviting you to be a part of rescuing 100 children. That's moving them from hunger into getting food for a year. So maybe it's you stepping up as a business benefactor. Maybe you can give a gift of $160 and rescue four children. Gifts of every size, every motivation are changing the world for children in Haiti. We just spoke to our office in Haiti. As you know, we have 400 staff members who are working tirelessly to get the food that arrives or they're able to purchase in country to these families. And because of the situation in Haiti, they are literally risking their lives, but they know that on the other side of their efforts are families who are perishing in isolation. And so I just think of you as you're listening now, you begin this cascade of grace. You begin this cascade of a future because everything is in place, as you mentioned, Dan. There are logistics. There are pastors and ministers ready to distribute it, whether they're driving a pickup truck or a 18-wheeler or bringing a wheelbarrow to the distribution center. They have families who are clinging to life right now. And your gift, begins everything. There is no food for the poor without you. We are a bridge between your generosity and these families who are waking up wondering, is there going to be food today? Because of your one-time gift, the answer is going to be yes.
She is Anitra Parmalee. She's a fundraiser for Food for the Poor. And Amy, again, that information on the Business Benefactor Program.
Yes, call Ann Jeanette Natowski at 847-472-8951. Write it down, 847-472-8951, or visit 560theanswer.com/foodforthepoor.
Anitra, thanks so much. As always, appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. I love having a front row seat to see God move through your listeners.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.